In 2011, the San Francisco Symphony celebrates its 100th season. Since 1925, the orchestra has been making recordings. I'm Scott Fogelsong, a contributing writer and pre-concert lecturer here at the Symphony. For some years now, I've been exploring the Symphony's long and distinguished history and recorded sound, a vast treasure of music preserved in commercial recordings, in radio broadcasts, and from the Symphony's own archives. I invite you to join me in these podcasts as I share some of my favorite moments drawn from 85 years of great recordings by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. On this podcast, we'll hear some of the guest conductors who have brought their talent and insight to the San Francisco Symphony over the years. Today's orchestras, with their long seasons, make abundant use of guest conductors. But that wasn't always so. Consider that until 1980, the San Francisco Symphony was still a part-time orchestra. It being a short season, the music director conducted most of the concerts. Nonetheless, guest conductors were featured every season, and some of those guests were regulars who could be counted on to make steady appearances. We have three sources for symphony recordings with guest conductors. First are commercial recordings, that is, albums produced by record labels that you could buy at your local record store. Back when there were record stores. Next, radio broadcasts, in particular the surviving transcriptions of standard hour broadcasts from the 1940s through the early 1950s, together with surviving copies of KKHI broadcasts from the 1960s through the early 1970s. Last, but definitely not least, we have the Symphony's own in-house recordings of its concerts, an archive begun in 1972 and continuing to the present day. That archive also preserves radio broadcast feeds made for stations KKHI, then KQED, and now KDFC. Given the sheer volume of material available, I'll be focusing on the first two of those sources for this podcast, commercial recordings and broadcast transcriptions dating before the advent of the Symphony's archives. Some of the recordings I'm covering are commercially available, but not all of them are. Let's start with the commercial studio recordings. First up, Leopold Stokowski and his two albums on RCA Red Seal, dating from the early 1950s during the two-year interim period between Pierre Monteux's departure and Enrique Jordá's arrival. Stokowski's 1952 album of selections from Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov featured the San Francisco Opera Chorus and bass Nicola Rossi-Lemini. It was so cherished by its owners that nowadays tracking down a copy of the original LP in even remotely playable condition is next to impossible. Fortunately, the original masters were on magnetic tape, from which modern technicians have made crystal-clear digital remasters. No wonder it was so popular. The vivid hi-fi audio alone was enough to send any self-respecting audiophile into ecstasy. And was there ever a conductor more suited to Mussorgsky's technicolor grandiosity than Leopold Stokowski? Add to that a San Francisco Symphony in red-hot fighting trim after Monteux's 17-year tenure. Well, hear it for yourself. Fasten your seatbelts, because here comes the conclusion of the coronation scene.
Yeah. Wow.
Stokowski followed it up a year later with Morton Gould's effervescent romp for two pianos and orchestra, The Dance Variations. His soloists were Arthur Whittemore and Jack Lowe, popular duo pianists who were to play the work that same year under Dimitri Mitropoulos and the New York Philharmonic. I have both performances in my collection, and there's just no comparison. Our band plays those New Yorkers under the rug. The finale of Dance Variations is a breathless and thrilling tarantella. Now, you might remember that dancing the tarantella was thought to ward off death from tarantula bites. Gould treats us to musical black comedy at its best by basing his main melody on the Gregorian chant Dies Irae from the Requiem Mass. Just in case you need a refresher on liturgical plain chant, here's the Dies Irae.
Dies Irae, Dies Ira, Solves Egum Invadina, Teste Dagicum Sibila.
And now, here's the Gould. For the next 40 years, San Francisco Symphony commercial albums were conducted by the orchestra's music director, Enrique Horta, Seiji Ozawa, Edo DeVart, Herbert Blumstedt. But in 1994, associate conductor Alasdair Neil led the symphony in Colored Field by Aaron J. Kernis, a composer with strong ties to the Bay Area, having been a student at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. I was his piano teacher, in fact. The symphony had commissioned Colored Field as a concerto for English horn. Kernis's score was inspired by a visit to Auschwitz, once a scene of horror, but now a place where a little girl could sit peacefully on the ground and nibble on a blade of grass. The third movement, Hymns and Tablets, seeks détente between these images of evil and serenity by invoking the spirit of Moses the lawgiver via juxtapositions of block chord passages with sections reminiscent of Hebrew and Christian chant. In 1997, John Adams, formerly the symphony's composer-in-residence and one of the most important American composers of our time, returned to the symphony to lead a new recording of his Harmonium, originally recorded by Edo de Vart and the orchestra in 1984. Adams has described the work's opening as, quote, a single tone coming out of a vast empty space and, by means of a gentle unfolding, evolving into a rich, pulsating fabric of sound. Here is that opening. Several other conductors have made commercial recordings with the symphony, including associate conductor Edwin Outwater and Broadway specialist Rob Fisher, who led an all-star cast through an unforgettable concert presentation of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd in the summer of 2001. Now let's take a look at guest conductors whose work has been preserved via radio broadcasts. The beloved West Coast institution, the Standard Hour, began in the late 1920s and continued into the early 1950s. Transcription discs have survived of broadcasts from 1941 through about 1952, during Pierre Monta's heyday, so the lion's share of those transcriptions preserve Monta's art for us. But Monta wasn't the only conductor on those broadcasts. The San Francisco Symphony wasn't the only orchestra either. Figuring out which orchestra is playing can be very easy. Announcer John Grover just might tell you.
Pierre Monta is conducting the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra.
Maybe the broadcast originates from Los Angeles. So that's easy too. It's the LA Phil. But sometimes they call it the Standard Symphony Orchestra. And what, pray tell, is that? It's the name that was used for autumn and summer broadcasts. So all you really need is the broadcast date, and you've got it. It's the opera orchestra in the autumn and the symphony in the summer. Therefore, I can say with confidence that this January 1949 performance of Pamina's aria from Mozart's The Magic Flute, with popular San Francisco soprano Dorothy Werenschold, presents us the San Francisco Symphony conducted by William Steinberg, at the time the conductor of the Buffalo Philharmonic. Years before he achieved Broadway immortality as the author of the hit musicals The Music Man and The Unsinkable Molly Brown, Meredith Wilson was a popular presence on the San Francisco musical scene. Wilson conducted the symphony on a number of occasions, sometimes including his own locally flavored symphonic works. I particularly enjoy his romp through Victor Young's score for the movie For Whom the Bell Tolls, broadcast on July 7, 1946, the Standard Hour's 1,000th broadcast. Fabian Savitsky was the Russian-born conductor of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. He's almost forgotten now, but he enjoyed a solid and successful career. He guest-conducted the symphony for two broadcasts in mid-July 1949, both featuring some high-voltage soloists. Not only Dorothy Werenschuld making another always welcome appearance, but also violinist Yehudi Menuhin and the legendary tenor Lawrence Melchior. Here's announcer John Grover introducing Melchior, who's going to have himself some fun with a romantic bonbon as Savitsky and the symphony provide an appropriately lush backup.
In his appearances on the screen, Lawrence Melchior has sung much beautiful music, and from this music he has selected as his next number the song Spring Came Back to Vienna by Spielmann, Mr. Melchior.
Sing, for in her heart was spring. The merriness of May was in her voice, and she was gay. The sunshine from her skies was smiling in her eyes. Then winter came to chill her with war and pain to fill her. But winters come and go, and spring returns to melt the snow. Came back to Vienna to bloom again. Spring came back with the lilac of youth again. Songs that lived in the winter are ringing in the air. People are singing everywhere. There will be waltzes and laughter and love ever after. For spring came back to Vienna to dry her tears. Spring has always come back for a thousand years. Now she'll powder her face and be lovely as before in Vienna.
In 1953, the Ampex Corporation conducted a test of stereo tape recording via a standard hour broadcast with the esteemed Los Angeles conductor Alfred Wallenstein on the podium. What a joy it is to hear the San Francisco Symphony in bright, clear stereo so shortly after the Pierre Monteux era. Here's Kodály's delectable Viennese musical clock from the popular Ari Janosch suite.
Thank you.
symphony returned to broadcasting in 1963, when Joseph Cripps authorized a series of Friday night live broadcasts on radio station KKHI. I have been fortunate to collect a series of off-air dubs of some broadcasts from enthusiasts with home tape recorders. Not only do those broadcasts document Cripps's transformative leadership, but they also provide us with some fine examples of the day's headline conductors at the helm of the San Francisco Symphony. Boston's Charles Munch conducted the broadcast of February 21, 1964. His focus was the French repertory that he knew so well. Here, he takes the orchestra through Ravel's La Valse, a work that Pierre Monteux had recorded for RCA way back in 1941. The orchestra's increasing technical polish is on display as Hans Schmidt-Eserstedt conducts the magnificent Seventh Symphony of Antonin Dvorak on a broadcast of February 17, 1967. I rather shudder to think how this might have sounded just 5 years earlier when the symphony was in disarray after Enrique Horta's ill-starred tenure. But after 4 years of Cripps's rebuilding, the symphony absolutely nails it. Schmidt-Eserstedt may not have been the most imaginative conductor on the block, but he certainly brought a fine sense of pacing to this great symphony's finale. March 7, 1969, quite near the end of Joseph Cripps's tenure, Detroit maestro Sixtin Ehrling led the symphony through a splendid concert that included Ravel's La Valse, Verdi's Overture to La Forza del Destino, the Nielsen Fifth Symphony, and the Sibelius Violin Concerto, with San Francisco's own Isaac Stern at the peak of his powers. The concert offers abundant evidence of the orchestra's transformation under Joseph Cripps. All lingering traces of a plucky regional orchestra have vanished. This is a big league band, characterized by technical polish, fine intonation, rich and powerful strings, and, most importantly, a palpable sense of confidence in its own excellence. ¶¶ Thus, when Seiji Ozawa brought the symphony back to the recording studio in 1972, after a 12-year hiatus, the orchestra was ready to take its rightful place on the world stage. Consider the symphony right on the eve of that return, January 29, 1971, with guest conductor Lauren Mazel leading a scintillating performance of the second of Béla Bartók's Deux Images. Guest conductors. They have been many and varied. We'll have many more. I think I'll give our closing to one of those guests. Maybe he lacked the star power of a Leopold Stokowski or the stature of a Charles Monch, but he was on the podium of the San Francisco Symphony on March 16, 1973. And in that capacity, the fine Italian maestro Aldo Ciccato gave us an absolutely glorious rendition of the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony. Here's the finale. On my next podcast, we'll hear some of the first chair soloists whose superb playing has graced the San Francisco Symphony over the years.